placement test, that the schools in this country, that the test scores among, since we've required all the schools to have basic standards, test scores among African Americans and other minorities have gone up steadily.
Can I say what
now,
some people...
Let me just finish. Now, wait a minute. You started this, and every question you've asked has been hostile and combative. So you listen to my answer. Will you do that?
They've been critical.
Now, you just listen to me. You ask the questions, and I'm going to answer. You have asked questions in a hostile, combative, and even disrespectful tone, and you have never been able to combat the facts I have given you. Now, you listen to this.
That was Bill Clinton on Election Day in 2000 calling into our radio station WBAI in New York to hear the whole interview. It went on for over a half an hour. You can go to democracynow.org. That was 16 years ago on Election Day 2000. Tune in tonight on your local station or right here at democracynow.org. We're bringing you a five-hour election night special from 7 p.m. Eastern Time to midnight at least. And a very happy birthday to Kieran Craig Meadows. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkner, Mean Shea, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Gester, Sam Malkoff, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Laguerre, and Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Aaron Dooley, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Due to KBOO's live election night coverage, the special finance committee meeting and the program committee meeting are canceled. The Finance Committee will meet Wednesday, November 16th at 4:30 p.m., and the Program Committee will meet Tuesday, December 13th at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Chuck Collins, speaking Tuesday, November 15th, 7 p.m., at the First Unitarian Church, Elliott Chapel, in Portland. Chuck Collins is the author of Born on Third Base. A one percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. He'll be talking about the people's movement of disadvantaged communities and communities of color's need to engage with the 1% community and the 1%'s need to step up and get involved. Again, that's Chuck Collins speaking Tuesday, November 15th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, Elliott Chapel, at 1211 Southwest Main Street here in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Up next is your Tuesday news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Water Bureau announces that no, the lead in the lead content in drinking water in town does not violate any EPA limits.
Starting next month, alcohol servers in Oregon will be permitted by the OLCC to drink on the job, just not that much.
And UN Attorney General Ban Ki-moon announced in a statement today that middle-class liberals residing in the U.S. are experiencing levels of stress that are, quote, disproportionately inflated considering the high quality of life that they'll continue to enjoy beyond the election, regardless of the outcome, end quote.
That last headline's not really true, is it?
Nah, I just made that up.
Oh, okay. Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 8th, 2016. I am Tony LaTigra.
And I'm Ken Jones. At this time, we'd like to remind our KBOO listeners that the polls close at 8 o'clock tonight. You have until then to bring your ballots to an official drop site or to your county's election office. You can find the nearest drop site by going to the Oregon Secretary of State's website at sos.oregon.gov. Remember, your vote matters.
The Oregonian projects that as many as 600,000 voters will have cast their ballots by the time polls close tonight, shattering the record of 449,000 set in 2014. The expected high voter turnout is not only due to the highly charged presidential election, but also to many other races and ballot measures. One of the most contested is ballot measure 97, the corporate tax measure. Latest polls show support of the measure is slightly ahead. Another extremely close race is that for Oregon Secretary of State between Commissioner of Labor and Industries, Brad Avakian, and former state representative, Dennis Richardson. Both ran well-funded campaigns, and the latest polls show a virtual draw at this point.
Housing affordability and density were among the issues not discussed by our presidential candidates this season. But right now, there's a lot going on around analysis of why McMansions are bad for our towns. Here to talk about that is Madeline Kovacs with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. She's with their Portland for Everyone program. Madeline, thanks very much for coming into KBOO on Election Eve.
Thank you very much for having me on Election Eve.
Madeline, first, what is a Portland for Everyone?
Sure. Portland for Everyone is a coalition of local nonprofit organizations, community-based organizations, individuals, businesses, and activists who basically want to bring back housing options within our residential neighborhoods that can be smaller, more flexible, and more affordable to more Portlanders. We also work in coalition with a lot of people on things like inclusionary zoning, the bond measure for affordable homes that we're all voting on today, yay, and other ways to get at the affordability question as more people come to our city and it gets more challenging.
Oh, can you tell us a little bit about that bond measure today? There are probably people still filling out ballots and maybe dropping them off.
There probably are, and I think the Welcome Home Coalition, I think they're going to bring it home. Fingers crossed. It's a really good measure that's going to provide affordable homes for about 1,300 people.
And what measure is that? Just so we can, did you remember the number on
that? No, I don't. I'm actually not on that campaign.
Oh, okay. Now, in the election itself, especially with national media, there's been, it seems almost a blackout on housing issues. Not one presidential candidate has mentioned affordable housing. Why is that?
Well, the candidates haven't mentioned it, but the White House did. Actually, about 3 weeks ago, the White House put out a great paper on housing affordability writ large and strategies that municipalities and cities across the country should be focusing on. And among the things that they called out were things like accessory dwelling units. One of the things that the residential infill project is proposing to do is to allow more flexibility for backyard cottages or internal conversions of homes. So meaning that you can divide a property into more units that are a little bit smaller in a way that really is in keeping with the neighborhood. The White House report also mentioned things like inclusionary zoning, funding for affordable housing, construction excise taxes, and I really encourage people to look up the White House report.
So even though people in Portland feel that we're the only ones in the country affected by gentrification and demolishing old houses and homeless problems, it's really a national problem, and the White House has issued a report to address this.
It is, although I think people do have it right when they think Portland's being really hard hit right now. We have a lot of people moving here very quickly. Things are changing, and I think people are definitely feeling that. We can definitely see it. We can definitely see what's happening in our neighborhoods, and we can definitely feel that loss of affordability happening very quickly. I think in Portland, though, we're lucky because we're working on the comprehensive plan right now. We're working on the residential zones project, so we have planning opportunities at the city level to do what we can to use land use and other regulatory measures to rein in demolitions, to rein in the McMansions that are being built, and to put rules in place that would change the rules of the game in these residential neighborhoods so we can build more housing types that are going to serve more people at a price point that they can afford. Even nonprofit developers are being priced out of single-family neighborhoods right now, which is why a lot of nonprofit homeowners and housing affordability programs and builders are part of the Portland for Everyone coalitions because they can't serve the demographics that they've been used to serve unless they go to Gresham. So this is really housing affordability writ large in Portland. I think people are feeling that.
Can you define McMansions? I know it's somewhat of an ambiguous term. Derogatory, obviously.
It would be a very large house that is out of scale with the rest of the houses around it. So we see a lot of more modest, smaller homes coming down, being replaced with something, I kid you not, code right now on one 5,000 square foot lot allows you to build a 6,000 square foot house. The residential infill project would bring that down to a maximum of 2,500 square feet, which reduces building footprints, makes it easier to preserve trees, and basically brings down the price of the money that you can spend to both put in and buy the next house. And it also splits land costs so that what's coming in you basically do two things. One is you decrease the amount of demolitions because it's no longer valuable to tear down a smaller house and put up a huge one. You just can't do it anymore. And if something were to come down, you would have to put in either multiple units or something smaller scale or more flexible that's more in keeping with what we'd want to see. So the McMansion is the term for that really big monstrosity that's not serving our demographics right now.
Well, now we can use it. Yeah. Because we know what it means. Can you talk about, there was a recent study on openhousing.net that showed McMansions, and I'll use the term now, are economically bad for communities. Why are they bad?
They're bad for a number of reasons. The first thing is they're bad if you care about climate change. The single most effective thing that you can do to bring down resource and consumption, and especially carbon dioxide emissions, is to limit the size of the house. The Oregon DEQ actually did a really great study of different measures that one can take in the building industry and homes in particular. And Portland for Everyone has been backing two major things. One is we really want to preserve as much housing stock as we can. And we've been saying that from the beginning. If you allow people to internally convert, to add a unit, to add a backyard cottage, and raise the value of what's on that property, you don't, you know, send material to the landfill and, you know, lose all of the essentially energy that's in the building to begin with. It takes from construction and everything else. Also, reducing the size is better than any LEED or any other standard that you could possibly put into place for a medium-sized house. So just building small and building neighborhoods that are more transit-enabled, more bike-friendly, more walkable, lets people drive less, cuts down on vehicle miles, cuts down on parking. Like, there are so many benefits. So that would be one. I think another is just that we have, our families are changing, and the families, what families need to buy and where they want to live and the size of those families are also changing. So we're just, what's in our codes today in residential neighborhoods is just out of scale with both what people can afford and where, and what people want to buy. There's actually a huge market for smaller 1,000 square foot units that millennials, that older adults, if they're made accessible, want to downsize into, and we're just not building it. But actually the Johnson Economics Report that recently came out highlighted the fact that there's a very, very deep market for these smaller, more affordable market rate units in Portland. The demand is huge. So
would that include tiny homes too?
Yes,
we've been hearing quite a bit about that too.
It does. And that's actually, tiny homes are actually one of the most flexible, discrete ways that we can house more people. And the caveat I would make with that are tiny homes are, you know, pretty flashy and get covered in the news a lot, but people don't tend to think about mobile homes as well. So there's actually Living Colleen, some other groups are doing a really great job also advocating around how do we advocate for people in mobile home parks too.
There's also been several articles recently about people who had relatives or friends living in their backyard, maybe in a second home in the yard, and that's against code in a lot of neighborhoods. Would this plan allow housing like that?
I would say in a lot of cases, probably yes. It depends on the same building code and, you know, livability standards would still apply. What this would do would allow two accessory dwelling units, quote unquote, per lot. So what someone could do is legalize that backyard cottage, bring it up to code, or build a new one. They could also add another unit in their existing house. So it's one, quote unquote, internal ADU that's just in keeping with the, you know, in the exact same envelope as the house, and then one external ADU, which is like a backyard cottage or something like that. So this would open up flexibility to be able to provide actual housing for more people in a way that is compatible.
And before the interview, you and I talked about possible opposition to the plan, and you were kind enough to say that you'll on the air, you'll let people know what some people are opposed to in the plan and your response to that.
Sure. Part of the opposition is actually pretty confusing because the residential infill project was pretty much tailored to address three things. It was tailored to address to reduce demolitions because, understandably, people are really upset about the amount of demolitions that are going on in Portland, and that makes sense. The second thing was it was supposed to address houses being built on narrow lots. People didn't like a lot of the features of those narrow houses coming in. And it was also meant to address this quote-unquote missing middle housing that we've been talking about, which is everything in between your standalone single-family house and then your, like, you know, 5-over-1 four-story apartment building that we see on our centers and courts. We are not building in, and single family zones are 45% of the city's land area. So we're not building smaller, flexible, more affordable housing types like cottage clusters or even duplexes or triplexes. We're not building those kinds of things anymore. And those are what made our neighborhoods, our inner neighborhoods in Portland, walkable and vibrant in the first place. If you look at a lot of places now zoned single family in the 20s and 30s, we actually built a range. So to get back to the opposition, the Johnson Economics report that came out recently, a couple weeks ago, you can look it up on the BPS website. It doesn't address all development scenarios. It doesn't include ADUs. But that basically shows exactly what we've been saying from the beginning, which is if you eliminate McMansions, number one, if you bring down the developer's ability to demo a smaller, more affordable house and put up a huge one in its place, if they have to do something more creative with the lot or you legalize internal conversions and incentivize keeping the house, you're going to get less demolitions. And I think that's the number one thing that people are most angry about. And it's also the number one thing that is causing the most confusion is, what is the residential infill project actually responsible for? It hasn't gone into effect yet. None of the changes that we're seeing right now are a product of the residential infill project. It's actually being tailored to address people's major concerns. So there's a council hearing tomorrow. It should be really fun. And I'm hoping that everyone who is supportive of flexible housing options in our neighborhoods will come out and enjoy the fun.
So that's open to the public?
It is, yeah.
And can you tell us how the public can attend, where the housing council is and the time?
They can. It's actually at Portland City Council. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be at 2:00. Although if people are interested in testifying, the 1:00 staff's going to come out, I think, at 1:00 with a sign-up sheet.
Madeline, again, thanks very much for coming into KBOO. That was Madeline Kovacs of 1000 Friends of Oregon. You can connect with them online at www.portlandforeveryone.org.
All right. Last month, SeaWorld's worth in the market reached an all-time low of $12 a share. And SeaWorld will no longer feature shows with killer whales at any of their aquatic parks. Since the independent documentary Black Fish was released in July of 2013, SeaWorld's profits have taken a substantial nosedive, dragging down stock value along with them. Chief Executive of SeaWorld, Joe Manby, announced an aggressive cost cut of $65 million and said the Shamu experience of watching killer whales will not continue past the end of this year. Tracy Ryman, head of animal rights advocacy group PETA, criticized SeaWorld as they announced the decision for, quote, adding meaningless cosmetic decorations to its stadiums, continuing to force orcas to jump and splash for a reward of dead fish, and painfully inseminating dolphin mothers.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for KBOO's election coverage coming up next. We'll be bringing you all the latest updates and crashing the Willamette Week's party at Grand Central Bowl. Coverage goes until 9 p.m. tonight. Tomorrow's weather, if the apocalypse doesn't happen first, will be partly cloudy with highs in the low 60s on both sides of the Cascades. Evening lows will be in the upper 40s. Today in history, in 1864, the first presidential election to fall on November 8th took place, which saw President Abraham Lincoln reelected to a second term in office after running against Democratic opponent George B. McClellan. The presidential election has fallen on November 8th 7 times since Congress standardized federal elections in 1845 to happen on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. The quote of the day comes from President Lincoln, who said, quote, "Elections belong to the people. It's their decision. If they decide to turn their back on the fire and burn their behinds, then they'll just have to sit on their blisters."
It's 5:18 p.m. and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In one of Agatha Christie's murder mysteries, the key clue that solved the whodunit was not something that happened, but something that did not take place. Specifically, a dog did not bark. That plot fits one of the great mysteries of this year's Trump-Clinton race for president. There was no barking at the democracy-murdering power of big corporate money in our politics. A record expenditure of at least $6.6 billion flooded into this national election, most of it from a handful of plutocratic interests blatantly buying controlling shares of the White House and Congress. That's why a phenomenal 78% of the public is united in support of overturning the Supreme Court's disastrous Citizens United decision. It opened the floodgates to this corrupting torrent of cash, producing public policies that profit corporations at the expense of the common good. With so much at stake and such overwhelming public agreement for stopping this wholesale purchase of America's democracy, how odd that both major candidates have been unwilling to bark at Citizens United. Of course, what we have here is a neon example of the political cowardice created by the politics of big money. Hillary Clinton has relied almost entirely on Super PAC and Wall Street funding of her campaign, and the Donald, who started out bragging about being rich enough to self-finance his run, has in fact been backed by millions of dollars from sleazy billionaire oligarchs like casino baron Sheldon Adelson. This is Jim Hightower saying, rather than running on this fundamental issue of Democratic power, the two top candidates are running from it, but they can't hide from it. This is a we the people moment when the grassroots bipartisan majority must take charge from craven politicos, not only barking ferociously at them, but also biting them. To join the effort, go to www.democracyisforpeople.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Hell hath no fury like a fast food chain shorn of its rightful profits. McDonald's is suing the city of Florence, Italy, for refusing to allow the famous-slash-infamous restaurant chain to establish itself in the city's historic Central Plaza to the tune of $20 million. Dario Nardella, the mayor of Florence, rejected McDonald's bid to open a branch in the Piazza del Duomo in June. Nardella's decision was upheld on appeal in July. Regulations aimed at preserving the historic character of the area stipulate the use of local products. Last month, the Vatican was reportedly incensed over a proposed McDonald's branch adjoining St. Peter's Square. McDonald's recently debuted a new burger that's filled with cheese and then deep fried.
In a bold and renewed struggle against multinational trade, Somali pirates have begun attacking ships seeking passage around the Horn of Africa through the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. Since the end of October, there have been two significant reports of pirate attacks on freighters, both of which were ultimately fought off by hired private security forces. Between 2008 and 2011, over 700 hostages and 30 vessels were attacked and held by pirate groups originating from the Somali coast. An overwhelming and concerted effort from countries including the United States, the European Union, Iran, and South Korea reduced pirate attacks to zero last year. Meanwhile, on the coast of Somalia, peace talks between two neighboring regions broke down, with the ensuing clashes causing 29 deaths. It's also reported that Al-Shabaab, a revolutionary and fundamentalist militia group, is building up a base of power in the region, hoping to join the fray and engage the use of pirate activity as a means of funding. All ships passing through the trade route have been advised by the Office of Naval Intelligence to be on high alert.
What do we picture when we hear the word Iran? Usually men and women dressed in black Islamic robes, separate education for boys and girls, modesty, and austerity. Few remember that years ago, Iran was the most liberal country of the Middle East, and the lifestyle of common Iranians, at least in big city, was quite similar to the countries of southern Europe, such as Spain or Italy. 35 years ago, the Islamic Revolution changed the political regime, but it could hardly change people's habits and world views. Free Speech Radio's news, Garigan Kumarian, takes a look at one technique that common Iranians use to overcome prohibitions and do simple things that people in many other countries take for granted.
Ali walks across the floor of a restaurant where he works, bearing what would be forbidden literature in his homeland of Iran. He opens the booklet and reads off internationally recognizable names.
Absolute Smirnoff, Viskiner, Vodka,
Guinness. Smirnoff Absolut or Jack Daniels have a universal meaning in all languages, but they take on an additional nuance when pronounced with a slight Persian accent. Ali is a waiter in Yerevan, and the city is home to a particular type of tourism, one in which Iranians can escape religious dress codes and the alcohol prohibition that has been in effect since the country was declared an Islamic Republic in 1979. Despite the ban on alcohol, Ali says he used to drink more when he lived in Iran.
In Iran, there's everything your heart desires. You can find everything from this menu there. Of course, it's not freely distributed, but it exists. Vodka, whiskey, brandy, wine. It's being smuggled from Armenia or Iraq or elsewhere. So nobody can claim that there's no alcohol in Iran at all.
Persistent consumption of alcohol is punishable by the death penalty under Iranian law, which is governed by a form of Sharia code. Rubi Ghahraman Monasyan, an Iranian expat and magazine editor, explains how Islamic laws developed in the 7th century work in the 21st.
They have two different types of police, the usual police, the one that exists in all countries, and so-called moral police, which is in charge of Islamic norms and prohibitions. Once, I was stopped in the street because of my long hair. They just warned me. Then, because of the sleeves of my t-shirt, they considered them too short. Another time, because I was just sitting with a girl in the back seat of a car, and so on.
Ghahraman Monasyan says enforcement has become less strict over the years, to the point that the morality police are as more annoying than dangerous. But they still prevent average Iranians from being able to do simple things that people do in most other countries without fear of reprisals. That's what tourism in Armenia has to offer.
It's hard to explain, but when I first left Iran many years ago, I experienced an odd sensation that a very heavy burden had fallen off my shoulders, a burden that I lived with but never felt before. And now, when I sometimes go back to Iran as a visitor, I start feeling that weight again.
Armenia is Iran's only Christian neighbor, and the 20-mile-long border region is a place where residents of the northern provinces of the Islamic Republic can drive to have a glass of beer, smoke a cigarette in public, dress as they like, walk the streets arm in arm, or go to a pop music concert.
Davut
Zivdar works in a modest office in Yerevan. There are no banners or signs outside, as he doesn't want to draw unwanted attention. His clients already know where to find him. The inside walls are covered with playbills and posters. This is show business in exile. Zivdar points out Iranian musicians who live abroad and arrange private concerts through his company, a galaxy of stars unable to perform at home. Most of these pop singers move to the United States and interact with their fans using stages of other countries. Zivdar says Armenia is the closest and the most convenient place for Iranian concerts in exile.
We have a similar office in Tehran where we accept ticket orders, and here we organize housing for the people coming to attend the concerts. So I think what our company is doing is more tourism rather than showbiz.
However, Iranians visiting Armenia do not fully comply with the definition of a tourist in the usual sense of that word. They are not so much interested in visiting sites and attractions, nor do they usually seek out Armenian cuisine. Henrik Navasardzian owns and operates one of the most popular Persian restaurants in Armenia, a favorite among Iranian guests.
Before the Islamic Revolution, there was a very popular wine variety in Iran. It was called Shirazi. When someone comes here for the first time, the first question is always the same. Do we have that kind of wine here? Of course we don't, because that wine and any other Iranian wine hasn't been produced for more than 35 years. But Iranians still remember it as a symbol of their past life, the pre-revolutionary years when Iran was the most liberal and free country of the Middle East. So they come to Armenia not for any Armenian things, but for quenching their thirst for the old Iran and their past lifestyle.
In that sense, Armenia is a time machine for Iranian visitors. It takes older generations back to past freedoms and gives the youngsters a vision of the future. Garagin Khumarian, FSRN, Yerevan, Armenia.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Please call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn, Jenna Yokoyama, Kanan Schlesinger, and Tony Glamourtramp Letigra. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and to our engineer, Wesley, quote, the potentiometer, Seiwei. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is the one and only Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Tony Glamourtramp Letigra.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning, if there is one, on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Rowland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. Paul will have a lot to talk about with election results. At 9, on Political Perspectives, hear activist, author, lecturer, and attorney Ralph Nader speak during his recent visit to Portland at Powell City of Books about his new book, Breaking Through Power. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Anderson and guest Jim Gilbert discuss plastic culture, fruit trees, and rhubarb. Get answers to your gardening questions. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Be sure to stay tuned to our alternative coverage of election night here on KBOO after the news. Till that time, good night, Tony. Good night, Wesley.
Good night, Wesley. Good night, Ken. Try to get some sleep tonight.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Winona LaDuke, speaking Saturday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the EMU Ballroom at the University of Oregon in Eugene. Winona LaDuke will speak on nature's historic position as property and the international call to legally recognize nature's right to exist, persist, and naturally evolve. This global movement is dedicated to normalizing the notion of rights of nature. Again, that's Winona LaDuke speaking on the rights of nature, Saturday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the EMU Ballroom on the corner of 19th Avenue and University Street in Eugene. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Fix-It Fair on Saturday, November 19th at 9:30 a.m. at Ron Russell Middle School in Portland. The Portland Fix-It Fair features exhibits and workshops from numerous community partners talking about issues such as water and energy savings, home and personal health, food and nutrition, community resources, recycling, and more. Childcare and lunch will be provided. Again, that's the Portland Fix-It Fair, Saturday, November 19th, from 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at Ron Russell Middle School, 3955 Southeast 112th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening, and you are listening to special election night coverage, Election 2016. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from RadioCab, the transportation choice of Portlanders since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. RadioCab has a mobile app that allows you to book a cab with your phone, available at the App Store, Google Play, or at radiocab.net. Or if you prefer, you can talk to a real person at 503-227-1212. This program has also been made possible by Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Hello and welcome to KBOO's election night coverage. I'm Ken Jones. I'm here with
Per Fogring.
And we give you kind of an alternative perspective on the election. You know, the big race tonight is the president. And Per, I keep forgetting who's running.
Fellow named Trump.
Yes. I think there was post-traumatic syndrome there.
And another Clinton.
Forget. And another Clinton. Mm-hmm. And we'll be updating you on returns coming in through the night. Probably we'll be getting our information from the same place you'll be getting yours from: CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, for some of you who are listening to Fox, the major networks, ABC, CBS, NBC. In the meantime, though, we have some interviews. We have reporters scheduled to report back to us from the election night party that KBOO and Willamette Week are sponsoring together at the Grand Central Bowl. By the way, you're all invited to come down there if you like. I think there's food and drinks. I think they're charging, though. It's Willamette Week, after all. And Grand Central Bowl is over on Belmont and 12th or so like that. And you're welcome to come down there and either celebrate or commiserate with like-minded folks. So in the meantime, we've got kind of a full night for you here up until 9 o'clock. There'll be a lot of races we'll announce. In the meantime, we also have some interviews. We have some commentary. We have those reporters from the party and from other places. And we have some Vox Pop audio where actual KBOO reporters went out and interviewed people like yourselves about the elections and related issues. Per, did you want to fill us in a little bit more on?
Well, I just, I happened to read a very interesting article from Foreign Policy magazine. And, a lot of people who, they can't stand Trump for obvious reasons, but they're very leery about voting for Hillary Clinton because of her rather hawkish record. And the basic gist of this article, which I kind of skimmed through, is the headline is, "If Clinton wins, her hawkish wings will be clipped." In other words, the Foreign Policy magazine is more or less pretty establishment-oriented, and they are saying that for several reasons that she's not going to be able to push through this, what people consider a warlike agenda. And the Foreign Policy magazine seemed a little sad about it. But, of course, I think most of our listeners will be a little bit relieved. And so if
certainly, I know there's quite a few people out there who went with Bernie in the primaries and were reluctant to vote for Hillary. But I think bit the bullet and went ahead and did that. So that's actually good news, I think, for a lot of our listeners.
Well, then, of course, in Oregon, which is a safe state, I think people can vote for the Green Party or Libertarian if they desire without fearing that it's going to get Trump into the White House, Of course, if you're...
I think there's actually a danger there, if I
really
could mention a personal story. Back when Al Gore was running against George W. Bush, I was living in Oregon. I cast my vote for Ralph Nader, and it didn't change the results of the Oregon election. The state went for Gore, but I haven't heard the last of it from my wife, and it's been about...
She still blames you. Well, that right. is weird, because there's lots of reasons to believe that, Bush... quote, won in Florida not because of Nader, but for all kinds of chicanery on the part of the Secretary of State in Florida, Her last name is Harris, I remember.
Yeah, and Catherine Harris.
Catherine Harris. Plus, you know, they wanted to have a recount, and some Republicans stormed into the recount office and sort of stopped things from going. I mean, it was a lot. You can't blame it all on Nader, you know.
No. but still, it's
tell
a reminder.
Tell your wife I said that.
That every, yes, I'll tell her, but every vote counts. We have coming up, we have that Vox Pop I talked about where we did have a KBOO reporter go out and talk to people on the street and come back with their impressions of the election. And then a very special guest in the studio. Actually, she's here right now, and we'll have that interview after the Vox Pop. We have Kate Titus with us. She's the executive director of Common Cause Oregon, and she'll talk to us about the election and, of course, Common Cause and some of the issues, national and local. In the meantime, we have Teresa Mitchell in the studio. And David, could you turn on Teresa's mic?
Red mic, here we are.
Teresa, you're going to be providing commentary throughout the evening, too.
I told Lisa I'd do color commentary, so I plan to be colorful. So
any opening remarks?
Well, here's your colors already.
Okay.
The Google is showing Donald Trump at 51%, Hillary Clinton at 46%, and that's because they're doing it from electoral votes. Of course, they just got started, so this doesn't mean anything yet. So it's Clinton with 44 electoral votes and Trump with 60, but that's very few.
What states are those?
Well, let's see. They don't name them, but I know that Tennessee. Oh, yes, they do. Tennessee is one of them.
Well, I know before I went on the news, too, they had called Indiana and Kentucky for Trump, of course, but that was expected. They called Vermont for Hillary, but several, since we've been here in front of the mic, several other states have come through.
Yeah, they're saying District of Columbia for Clinton, Tennessee for Trump, Alabama for Trump. Let's see, that's Alabama with 9 electoral votes, Tennessee with 11, South Carolina with 9. And let me see if I can get this thing to roll around.
Any projections on Florida? That's a big state, Virginia.
I saw on Florida that it was looking pink on a map. So that's all I have at the moment.
And now we do have that Vox Pop for you. And, of course, we'll have a lot more for you. Teresa will be checking the map there and giving you more of the statistics of the evening. But to get some insight into what's truly important, KBOO reporter Jenna Yokoyama brings us a Vox Pop where she asks people what law they would create if they could have their way.
If you could make a law and have it magically come true, what would it be? That's a question I decided to ask my fellow KBOO volunteers. The caveat? The law they create has to be a local Portland law. Answers ranged from silly to serious. Here's a few.
I would make a law that would say a person's rent, the amount of rent that they pay, can never be more than 30% of their income.
Mandatory 24-hour public transportation. 24-hour city. There's places we gotta go in the middle of the night.
Portland goes to sleep at 9 o'clock and then no one ever moves again. Don't you know that, Aaron?
Only the people who go to sleep at 9 o'clock thinks that that's really true.
I've just revealed a lot about myself.
I think that all new condos and apartments that are built, each unit should have their own parking spot underneath. And my other one would be, I wish the OLCC would allow concert venues to have all ages shows without a divider. I don't understand why they can't just give a wristband to people who are 21 and over like every other state.
I think that I would make it so that it was illegal for the police to harass people who are homeless or people of color in any way or treat them differently in any way. It's not just an accountability law. I guess it is, but it's like a law where their role by law would be to provide extra support and make sure people were safe. And if they did anything contrary to that, that there would be an accountability process that was really real.
People shouldn't drive like jerks, which it didn't used to be like that, and I miss that.
Stay tuned because we'll be back with more made-up local laws throughout the evening. For the KBOO News, I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
The new movement for open and accountable elections met last week with the Portland City Council to talk about why there are so few people of color in elected office and why big money seems to have a grip on our democratic process. Here to talk about what happened at that meeting is our special guest tonight, Kate Titus. Kate is the executive director of Common Cause Oregon. Kate, again, thanks very much for coming in on Election Eve.
Thanks for having me here.
First, I'd like to ask, again, to tie it into the election, can you talk about this emerging movement for open and accountable elections? Where around the nation are people working on this, and what is the goal?
Yeah, I'm really glad to be here on election night. Nothing is more relevant or important to this particular momentous election than this reform and the growing movement of reform, the grassroots movement of reform that's growing up around the country to try to fix the democratic process. We have just seen the most expensive election in human history, more money, obscene amounts of money being poured into this election. We've also seen an election that's particularly contentious. To all appearances, it really feels right now like we are a very divided country. And yet, on one issue, I would argue that we're more united than ever. If you look at the polls, it shows a cross-party line. Republicans, Democrats, third-party voters. There's unanimity around the problem. There's a real frustration with the way that money is influencing the political process, and a desire to reform that, to fix that, and to bring all voices back into the democratic process. So what we're seeing is a time when we're at an all-time low point with the problem, money in the political process, and yet we're also seeing a resurgence of grassroots effort to come and try to fix that. And across the country, even in this election cycle, we're seeing local reform efforts. Right here in Portland, we're working through the city council, but on the ballot in Berkeley, California, Howard County, Maryland, There are two local areas that are trying to pass a similar reform on the ballot. And then in Washington State, we're seeing a different model, but toward the same ends of a proposal that's on the ballot. We also see Washington State, California, both have ballot measures to try to call on Congress to overturn Citizens United. Missouri has a ballot measure for contribution limits. So we're really seeing these reforms bubble up.
So Citizen United, rather than having the Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court, overturn it, states can actually overturn it on a state-by-state basis?
Well, what we've seen with the courts is that in recent years they've been dismantling our whole regulatory system to rein in money in the process and make sure that the money that is